The cattle slurped greedily from the waters of the oasis. A few animals, those that had already drank their fill, munched at the grasses sprouting around the edges of the pond. A woman watched the lowing herd from her perch on the sand dune above. She took off her felt hat and scratched at an itching spot on her scalp. Lice were a constant problem. And then, inspired by the cattle, took a sip of her own precious water. She would have to refill the container before she took the herd over the dunes to the next oasis. The Tarim Basin was no place to be dehydrated. All of her people knew someone who had neglected their water intake and gone mad from thirst and heat. A terrible fate, and one she was determined to avoid. Still, there was a harsh beauty to this land. The way the dunes curved off into the distance, the faint shimmer of heat haze on a fiery day, the striking contrast between endless blue sky and vibrant ochre sand. The oases were islands of life in an otherwise desiccated landscape, archipelagos of trees and shrubs and grasses, breaking up the monotony of the desert in verdurous shocks of color against the expanse of rolling dunes. The woman and her people knew how to survive here. She had taken this small herd away from the braided streams and marshes near to the edge of the desert, where the waters ran down from the mountains to the south into this arid basin, to the oases. It was never easy to keep the animals on the shifting tracks through the dunes, and only those born to the terrain could hope to navigate it safely. One track through the sands looked very much like another, but she knew the difference. A lone tree here provided a landmark. A distinctive peak pointed the way toward a particular oasis there. Over there, the sprouting of shrubs told her that there was water deep below the surface. Her people had been newcomers to this land once. They had hunted wild game and gathered plants in the treacherous mountains for generations, but then life began to change. They acquired cattle and came down out of the mountains to this hard, demanding, even punishing land. Some might call it a difficult life, but for the woman and her band, it was all they now knew. The Tarim Basin was home. Others lived nearby who spoke a different language and had different ancestors. All were recent arrivals to the region, which was in the process of becoming the crossroads of Eurasia. Hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of Past Lives. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for being here today. The far west of present-day China, the region known as Xinjiang, seems at first glance, and maybe second and third glances as well, to be an inhospitable place. The enormous peaks of the Tian Shan tower more than 20,000 feet into the sky, separating two arid basins with nearly impassable mountains. The Dzungarian Basin in the north borders Kazakhstan and Mongolia and includes the spot on the planet most distant from any ocean, while the Tarim Basin in the south is mostly comprised of the Taklamakan Desert, one of the driest, harshest environments on the planet. The enormous rain shadow cast by the Himalayas mostly prevents rainfall here, while proximity to the open steppes to the north means that Siberian cold is also never far away. If you were making a list of places in the world that you'd like to live, this region of alternating belts of unwelcoming sand dunes and craggy mountains probably wouldn't be anywhere near the top. And yet, despite its aridity, vicious temperature swings, and lack of obvious resources, people have both passed through and made their homes in this region for thousands of years. Its location at the heart of Asia might deprive it of rainfall and render it vulnerable to Siberian cold, but Xinjiang is also the most important corridor linking the various regions of Eurasia. It is, and has been for millennia, a crossroads on an enormous scale. During China's imperial age, it was the heart of the Silk Road land routes that connected China first to the steppes and then to the Mediterranean beyond. The confederations of mobile pastoralists that dominated Central Asia for centuries, like the Xiongnu and the Uyghurs after them, either controlled or were based in Xinjiang. So vital was the region to the trade routes crisscrossing Eurasia. Centuries before the first camels loaded down with silk or herds of horses bound for the markets of urban China tramped along in the shadows of the Tian Shan, however, Xinjiang had already served as a crossroads for thousands of years. In today's episode, we're going to do something a little different from our usual focus on a single person. Instead, we're going to expand our view to talk about this extraordinary region, how archaeologists are studying it, and how those scholars are applying the most advanced new scientific tools to make sense of its long past. Then, Next week, we'll take what we've learned and use it to explore the life of a person who lived in the region nearly 4,000 years ago, the Princess of Xiaohe, one of the famous Tarim mummies, the preserved remains of the people who inhabited Xinjiang in a time so distant, the early Bronze Age, that it hardly seems real. This is the story of a particular region at a particular time. To tell it, we should start with geography. We're not talking about a tiny corner of China here, after all, but an enormous biogeographical region in its own right. The autonomous region of Xinjiang, its Chinese administrative designation, covers more than 640,000 square miles. That's about the size of France or Afghanistan, and the number doesn't include the connected areas that extend into present-day Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Mongolia, and the Gansu corridor of China. I already mentioned the Tian Shan, the range of mountains dividing the region into two parts, with the Dzungarian Basin in the northern half and the larger Tarim Basin in the south. The northern basin is a little more welcoming than the southern, with good grazing in the foothills of the Tian Shan and the Irtysh River providing regular water and a thin strip of viable farmland. In the Tarim Basin, the small rivers running down from the Tian Shan and the Tibetan Plateau feed a few oases, the only footholds for permanent human habitation. The high ridges, plateau, and mountains of Tibet lie south of the Tarim Basin, but in every other direction, Xinjiang offers the most viable route tying the two ends of Eurasia together. To the north are the Altai Mountains, where the headwaters of the Irtysh River can be found. The river's winding route between the Altai and yet another mountain range provides the best opening into the Dzungarian Basin and the route further west. Today, this is the closely guarded border between Kazakhstan and China, but in the ancient world, it was an open highway, a vital arterial route for trade and migration. The Tian Shan mostly blocked the route further south, on the borders of Kyrgyzstan, but the 12,000-foot-high Torugart Pass offers a treacherous way through the mountains, and that has been in use since antiquity. The city of Urumqi is now the capital of Xinjiang. It lies at the rough center of the region as a whole, and sits on the north-south route that connects the Dzungarian and Tarim Basins across the Tian Shan. To the east of Xinjiang, where the sands of the Tarim Basin and peaks of the Tian Shan peter out, is the Gansu Corridor. This narrow plain, never more than 60 miles in width but nearly 700 miles long, is the gateway to the Yellow River Valley and the heartland of both ancient and modern China. These basic geographic facts have dictated much of Xinjiang's history. It is the physical conduit through which most of the essential developments of the past 5,000 or so years were disseminated from east to west and vice versa. In more recent times, the Turkic languages now spoken across Asia traveled through Xinjiang, along with most of the horses on which Chinese aristocrats and cavalry soldiers rode. Mongol conquerors from Genghis Khan to Tamerlane turned it into one of the most vital invasion routes in history. But long before it became the Silk Road, this was the Inner Asian Mountain Corridor. Thanks to the existence of this route, the chariot, invented in the Eurasian steppe in the 3rd millennium BC, became the preferred vehicle of the nobles and kings ruling China's first historical dynasty, the Shang, in the late 2nd millennium. Millet, first domesticated along the Yellow River, went west. Wheat, sheep, and cattle, domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, went east. Despite the difficulty of the journey through the mountains and deserts, this long series of routes was Eurasia's earliest highway, and Xinjiang was its crossroads. Still, Xinjiang is a long way from just about everywhere else. It's especially distant from the fertile, well-watered river valleys that have hosted dense urban societies for the last five millennia. That physical distance is exacerbated by the end of the great nomadic empires in the late Middle Ages and the rise of global maritime trade after the 16th century. The past several hundred years are the time when, geopolitically and economically speaking, Central Asia and its environs are the least important they've been in the past 4,000 or more years. Xinjiang's value lay in its position as an intermediary between Central and East Asia. When the steppe heartland ceased to be as central to the global economy and politics across Eurasia, Xinjiang became a backwater of a backwater. As a result, it was largely left out of mainstream archaeological and historical narratives at precisely the time those disciplines were crystallizing. A few pioneering archaeologists traversed the old Silk Road in the early years of the 20th century. The legendary British explorer Orrell Stein made three trips to the region and recovered stunning artifacts, among them the legendary 1,000-year-old Buddhist manuscripts that had been sealed in a cave near Dunhuang. but in the wake of Stein and his contemporaries, sustained archaeological investigation of the region stopped for decades, as civil war, world war, and still more civil war disrupted life in Xinjiang. The Chinese government continues to rule the region with an iron fist now. What little information does get out looks pretty bad, to put it mildly. It's difficult for foreigners to get access to Xinjiang today. I remember interviewing an archaeologist friend who works in that region, Gino Caspari, who mentioned how closely the authorities were watching him while he was there. Chinese archaeologists are doing fantastic work, but much of what they're finding is published only in Chinese. The research that is being published and is accessible, however, is amazing. The recency of the work means that all of the most advanced scientific tools are being applied to freshly excavated sites. Ancient DNA is telling us who the inhabitants were related to and how their communities were structured. Isotope analysis is revealing what they ate. Paleoenvironmental studies have shown precisely how difficult it was to live in the deserts and oases of the region, and how people adapted to those conditions. But the benefits of doing archaeology in Xinjiang go beyond the availability of cutting-edge tools. Because of the aridity of the region, the conditions of preservation are absolutely ideal. The heat and lack of moisture mean that perishable materials like wool, wood, and paper don't decay as they would elsewhere. The Dunhuang manuscripts, the treasure trove of texts sealed in a cave and recovered by Oral Stein early in the 20th century, were just the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Among many other once-in-a-lifetime finds, Stein also found mummies. Lots and lots of mummies. The Tarim Basin is an ideal environment for preserving human soft tissue. It has the same hot, dry conditions we see in Egypt, the Atacama Desert of South America, and the Great Basin of the United States, all places where naturally mummified remains are commonly found. Unlike Egypt, however, few archaeologists have spent much time in Xinjiang, and discoveries of mummies have trickled in over the years. We're lucky that the excavations carried out over the past couple of decades have been so exact, done with incredibly high levels of technical proficiency, and with the eventual aim of analyzing everything found using the most advanced available tools. The possibilities for understanding the people who lived in this region in a time before writing are expansive, and we can look forward to still more reams of insights coming in the future. On a more basic level, however, there's something extraordinarily powerful about being able to look an ancient person in the face. Even by the standards of ancient mummies, the people found in the Tarim Basin are well-preserved. Some of them still have eyelashes, traces of the paint that was applied to their skin at the time of burial, and other easily identifiable features. Some look as if they might have been buried last year in their finely patterned and woven garments and distinctive felt hats. Many of these mummies appear, superficially, as if they're more closely related to people living farther west in Eurasia than anyone currently living between Xinjiang and the Pacific, particularly because of their blonde and red hair. This has led to all sorts of theories about who these people were, where they came from, and why they matter. A number of scholars working on the Tarim mummies have associated them with speakers of Indo-European languages belonging to the Indo-Iranian and Tocharian branches. In this telling, the mummies' features are Caucasoid, or Europoid, and only later did people physically resembling East Asians, Mongoloids, come to live in Xinjiang and its environs. If your alarm bells are ringing as I'm saying these things, good, you're not alone. This concept of ascribing racial or ethnic identity on the basis of physical appearance is at best pseudoscientific and at worst directly connected to really ugly white supremacist ideologies like those of the Nazis. The Tarim mummies still show up in some of the more esoteric far-right corners of the internet as examples of ancient white racial supremacy. The Chinese authorities didn't appreciate the repeated arguments that Xinjiang's ancestral inhabitants had come from Europe, with all of the attendant implications for politics and global hierarchies in the present. Because of this, the mummies can't be taken out of China, and few foreign archaeologists are even allowed to study them. The whole business of imputing ancestry and descent to ancient people on the basis of observable physical characteristics is nonsense. As we discussed in the case of the Ancient One a few weeks ago, morphology, physical appearance, is quite fluid in past populations. Hair color and the precise shape of the skull can reflect genetic ancestry, but that's something to be proven and not assumed. In my opinion, the worst part in this case is that these studies aren't even particularly old. They date to the late 1990s and early 2000s, well after their authors, quite frankly, should have known better. The only benefit to their recency is the fact that ancient DNA analysis of these very same mummies became available soon after, allowing us to firmly refute these ideas with the most solid possible evidence. Thanks to ancient DNA, we now have a new story about the origins of the Tarim Basin's early inhabitants. And that's a story that's far more compelling and nuanced than one of a dominant Europoid race migrating across Eurasia to the gates of China. The first traces of people living in Xinjiang date back tens of thousands of years, but they don't amount to much. They're just scatterings of stone tools that show Paleolithic humans were there for a while. The reason for this is probably environmental. In the depths of the last ice age, arid Xinjiang would have been even drier than it is now, and the towering mountains surrounding the region even more icy and forbidding than they are today. The few rivers and oases that gave life to the later inhabitants were even fewer or non-existent then. But we can guess that some milder interludes made it possible for the people who left those few traces to survive for a while. The archaeological record of the region really picks up during the early Bronze Age, however, around 2500 BC. That was when Xinjiang became the crossroads region it would remain for the next four millennia. We can track precisely who came there and from where. In the centuries after 2500 BC, not one, but several distinct groups of people began to move into previously empty Xinjiang. The first came from the Altai Mountains and surrounding steppe to the north. Known as the Qiemu Erqieke, that's Q-I-E-M-U apostrophe E-R-Q-I-E-K-E, for those of you who are wondering why I was having trouble pronouncing that, or Shemurchek culture. These were largely nomadic, pastoralist people who herded sheep and cattle and buried their honored dead in distinctive tombs before moving on to their next destination. The second group was the Tian Shan Bai Lu culture. These were farmers from the far western end of the Yellow River Valley who made their way through the Gansu Corridor and into eastern Xinjiang. Finally, there was the Xiaohe culture, the most distinctive of the bunch, who lived along the meager waterways of the Tarim Basin, herding cattle among the oases and marshes and burying their dead in boat-shaped wooden coffins. The last of these, the Xiaohe, is the best known today because it was their people whose mummies offer such a striking glimpse into a lost time and place. To understand these three groups, we need to take stock of the genetic and archaeological landscape of the region beyond just Xinjiang. All three of these groups were migrants into the region in the early Bronze Age, and each of them had a history extending back thousands of years into the past. Before they migrated, however, there had been groups of indigenous hunter-gatherers populating southern Siberia, the Altai Mountains, present-day Mongolia, and eastern Kazakhstan dating back into the depths of the last ice age. We see occasional tiny archaeological traces of these groups, whom DNA analyses place in an ancestry category called ancient North Eurasians, but they consist almost entirely of isolated burials and campsites separated by millennia. Around 24,000 years ago, a young boy died near Lake Baikal in Siberia. Known as Malta Boy, analysis of his genome demonstrated that he belonged to a distinctive population that formed during the Paleolithic. This is the population that geneticists call the ancient North Eurasians. Let's remember that a population, in genetic terms, isn't the same thing as an archaeological culture, much less a group that humans define and ascribe to in terms of their own identity. Population, in this context, means a group of people who share substantial amounts of ancestry. Ancient DNA experts go on to label these populations in ways that are helpful for talking about them over the very long term. There were other indigenous groups in this region as well, including one that lived further east called ancient Northeast Asians. Now, these patterns of ancestry persisted in the remote reaches of Siberia and Northeast Asia without much gene flow from the outside world for tens of thousands of years, even as other descendants of those ancestral populations traveled far and wide, ending up in both Europe and the Americas. Again, this isn't about cultural homogeneity, language, or identity, just ancestry. The people from these different groups in reality probably didn't think they had much in common with each other. At the beginning of the Bronze Age, however, everything changed. The highly productive cultures of the Yellow River Valley began to expand west into the Gansu Corridor and into the fringes of Xinjiang. On the other side of Xinjiang, pastoralists from the far west, among the earliest speakers of Proto-Indo-European to begin their long journeys across Eurasia, migrated east from the steppe north of the Black Sea to the vast grasslands of Kazakhstan and southern Siberia. Known as the Afanasyevo culture, these pastoralists introduced domesticated animals and the herding way of life to the eastern steppe, where it would become the default subsistence mode all the way up to the near present. The Afanasyevo people had a much different ancestry profile than the indigenous hunter-gatherers, who traced their roots directly back to the ancient North Eurasians and ancient Northeast Asians. While they shared some ancestral components, including a high portion of ancient North Eurasian ancestry, their specific mixture of genetic contributions developed far to the west. These different populations are easily distinguishable in ancient DNA studies. They don't cluster together in statistical models. When the Afanasyevo people arrived in the distant east and met the local indigenous hunter-gatherers, these distinctive groups, which had barely interacted over the past 20,000 years or even more, began to interbreed. The Chemerchek people, who came into Xinjiang from eastern Kazakhstan and the Altai, were mostly descended from the Afanasyevo, but with a bit of admixture from the hunter-gatherers. Most archaeologists assumed the Tarim mummies were descendants of the slightly admixed Afanasyevo, with their recent westward migration accounting for the quote-unquote Europoid features we see on the human remains. It turns out, however, that those assumptions, rooted as many of them were in white supremacist ideologies, were exactly backwards. The mummies of the Xiaohe culture, the extraordinarily well-preserved people whose faces still stare up at us from thousands of years in the past, shared zero ancestry with the migrating pastoralists in tens of thousands of years. They were descended solely from a combination of ancient North Eurasian and ancient Northeast Asian ancestry, an indigenous ancestry profile. What the scholars considered quote-unquote European features were actually the product of that deep-in-time hunter-gatherer heritage, not a recent migration from the West. But this is where things get even more interesting. The Xiaohe people had no traces of Afanasyevo ancestry in their DNA, but their lifestyle was based largely on pastoralism, specifically tending cattle, which had not existed in the region before the Afanasyevo arrived. The conclusion is straightforward. The forebears of the people buried in the sands of the Tarim Basin must have adopted domesticated animals from their new pastoralist neighbors, learned to milk cattle and process dairy products, and made them the basis of a brand new lifestyle in a region that had previously been unable to support their presence. The thin waterways and oases clinging to the fringes of the Tarim Basin weren't viable for foragers. There simply were not enough wild resources, plant or animal, for people to feed themselves consistently. But domesticated cattle could feed on the rich marsh grasses and reeds, and the Xiaohe people could turn the energy they consumed in grass into dairy products, meat, and hides, the foundation of a viable desert economy. We have no idea where exactly the foraging ancestors of the Xiaohe people lived. The archaeological and genetic record of this broad region, from Kazakhstan to Siberia, is poorly understood before the Bronze Age. Only a few sites have been found, and not many burials, so our grasp of these foragers' lifeways and population history is limited. The closest analogs for the ancestry of the Tarim mummies could be found in eastern Kazakhstan, where two individuals dating from the 6th millennium BC, about 3,000 years before the Xiaohe culture emerged, were recently discovered and analyzed. These two Neolithic foragers had that same combination of components, ancient North Eurasian and ancient Northeast Asian. And we now have enough data to say that this was probably standard throughout the Altai and surrounding areas of Inner Asia. Groups with similar genetic profiles could have been found across the region, tucked into isolated mountain valleys and river corridors. Any one of these groups might have been ancestral to the Xiaohe people. Pastoralism became the default way of life for groups living across eastern Eurasia after the Afanasyevo migration. But most of the societies that adopted pastoralism had interacted directly with the Afanasyevo. Ancient DNA analyses show evidence of interbreeding, such that later pastoralist groups in the east had some ancestry from the western steppe, even if they were largely descended from indigenous groups. That was the case in Mongolia, for example. But the Zhaohe are an exception and not the rule. Without ever engaging in an extended period of interaction with migrating pastoralist groups, they adopted aspects of their lifestyle, but only the parts that appealed to them. Armed with that new knowledge and a subsistence strategy, they developed a unique new culture that flourished in the forbidding surroundings of the Tarim Basin. And now, thanks to the revelations of ancient DNA and other bits of archaeological science, we can understand who they were and how they lived. Next time on Past Lives, we'll go much deeper into this isolated and fascinating culture, viewing the world through the eyes of one of the stunning mummies preserved in the sands of the Tarim Basin, the Princess of Zhaohe, who lived nearly 4,000 years ago. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. The Patreon is only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content, like Q&As, interviews with scholars, and much more. It's thanks to subscribers like you that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule, and thank you so much. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick, or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. This has been Past Lives.